All right, Supertones, let's rock.
On the upbeat, it's time to move your feet. On the upbeat, so come on and dance with me. Cause life is bitter, life is sweet, and it's got you on the edge of your seat. But you know that life is better, it's always better on the upbeat.
Welcome to On the Upbeat. I am your host, Matt Vest. And with me this week, no RJ this week, but with me this week is another Matt, Mr. Matt Morginsky from the Orange County Supertones. How's it going, Matt?
It's going well. Thanks for having me on. Catchy tune that you have at the top there.
And thank you. That was written by a band called... oh my gosh, my mind is blanking, and they're gonna be mad at me. Millington, yep. Millington. Yeah, okay. They're out of New York. They're a ska punk band. They popularized the term brass emo. That's their sort of like how they kind of define their sound. Brass emo. I mean, they do have a lot of ska, very traditionally ska punk, but. Brass emo is kind of the phrase. No RJ, sadly, he had stuff to do and could not make it this week. So Matt and I are just going to, it's the Matt and Matt show. That's what we're going to do. So Matt, I have
I think that we need to make sure that RJ gets proper grief from your listeners. So folks out there, I suppose you guys have a show contact.
Oh, sure. Yes, of course.
So I would take it as a personal favor from everybody. If you could just send enraged, just vitriolic emails to this guy who I've never met before.
Sure.
But thought something else was more important than me being on his show. So
Yeah. Just let him know that you can send it to, two places. Obviously, you can contact him anywhere that you know RJ online. And of course, you can just send it straight to ontheupbeatska@gmail.com. Just title it, "How Dare You, RJ?" And RJ will read that.
The more unhinged, the better.
Yes. All right. So I have a question, a ska-related question, not directly related to the Supertones, but I've been holding on to this question because I think some feelings might get hurt about, now, as you know, ska does not technically need horns to be considered ska, right? Sure. But if you're gonna have a horn in your ska band, what is the most important horn to have in your ska band?
That's tough. The thing is, it's like saying which is the most important offensive lineman, right? Yeah. They do work in concert, and so I can tell you from experience that we tried making I think a demo before our first record with just two saxophones, an alto, and a tenor, and the result was not good.
Yeah.
Partly the recording engineer did indeed mail it in, did not care. But also, you know, if you, even after our sax player left the band, we would put a sax on the record. Because I do think that if you don't have trombone, trumpet, and sax, tenor preferably, you're just not taking things seriously. You're not taking life seriously or ska seriously.
I would agree. I would agree that you need to have at least all three of those. But if you're only gonna have one, I say the trombone. I think the trombone is the most, I don't know, it helps with that like bouncy feel because it can slide.
It can get pretty high. Our trombone player, Dan, was a really fantastic player, actually. So his range was really good. And theoretically, but I don't want to listen to that record, to be honest with you, if it's only trombone.
A bunch of ska bands that only have trombone players are now all crying. They're all sad.
Yeah. Guys, go make friends with the band nerds. And find you a sax and find you a trumpet. Beef it up. You need some beefy horns.
I definitely do like the three-piece. I mean, I argue that Five Iron Frenzy horn section is the best, definitely the best, like, ska punk band horn section. Mostly I say that because they have, it's been the same people on every record. It's been the same tight unit. So that's my feeling.
They're outstanding. I'm not going to rank.
Yeah.
They're outstanding.
Yeah. Yes, they are outstanding. Yeah. I mean, I could, I'm sure there's a bunch of people who are, have a bigger understanding of ska history that would argue with me. I will concede that. Cause
no, I mean, right. The early guys who all went to that Catholic Reform school where they, do you know this story?
No, I do not. Fill me in.
So kind of the stock band that was on, you know, 100% of early ska records. Mm-hmm. Like the way it would work is, you know, they worked in a studio, and whether it was Prince Buster or whether it was Desmond Dekker or whomever would come in and say, "Hey, I've got a song." They're like, "Well, what do you want the backing to be?" And they say, "Well, we'll make it ska." Right. And these same guys, they were actually jazz players. Hmm. And there was, you know, like this reform school for delinquent youths that was run by Catholic Charities. And part of it was they would be taught jazz, how to play jazz. And so like awesome. It was the Scatolites essentially.
Right.
So Don Drummond and all those folks, they all went through that same reform school. And we're taught jazz, and so that's the
obviously I feel like a lot of music that was produced, you know, whether, you know, Jamaican ska back in the day or even what was being produced in America and pop music at the time, I feel like studio musicians were like a big part of it. I feel like bigger than they are now. Obviously they still exist, but
in Nashville, there's still a high premium on getting it right in one take. Because time is money in the studio, especially back in the day when studio time was really exorbitant. And so it was a matter of economy to have the best, you know, ringer musicians who just, you know, a lot of the time those early ska records, apparently they didn't rehearse, right? They were stock strong song structures. You know, a lot of it in that 12-bar 1-4-5. Are you a musician?
I'm not. Okay. I mean, I do have, I was in choir for a long time, so I do have some general understanding.
So my musicians out there who know your scales, 1-4-5, it's also the same as 12-bar blues, right. You can hear the similarity,
right?
So you start on the first note, right, and then you go up to the fourth and then up to the fifth and back to the one,
right? So yes, we definitely do have a lot of professional musicians that listen to this show and who are better reading music and are understanding music than I am, so I'm sure they appreciate all that data. I do too. I appreciate the story of coming from the same sort of school
almost like you know, the Funk Brothers with the Soul Records and all that.
Right. Yeah. All right. So that was a great conversation. I'm glad I asked that question because it went places I couldn't have imagined. You know, imagine asking that question, like people feeling. Maybe it was good that I asked the question with just one other person on the chat today, because there wasn't this I didn't get a bunch of horn players in the room arguing over who was the what is the more important. So, all right, so we're gonna jump in some ska news right now. So let's do that. Here we go, ska news.
Rude girls and rude boys too. Grab your friends and listen to what we're telling you. I'm sorry, you might have heard, but Kevin, you're about to miss me in ska news.
That's right, ska news, where we try to tell you about the latest releases in ska, at least all that we can do in like a 8-minute segment. All right, so first up, I want to tell you about our friends in Bite Me Bambi. On January 9th, Bite Me Bambi released a song called Bad Boyfriend. You can find the video on the band's YouTube page, and you can Get Bad Boyfriend. It's streaming everywhere now. And let's take a listen to the clip of the song. So here's Bad Boyfriend by Bite Me Bambi. That was Bad Boyfriend by Bite Me Bambi. I can tell Matt is, have you heard of Bite Me Bambi?
No, I've never, I don't really keep up much. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
But it was reminding me, there was a band, a glam rock band called Danger Danger.
Mm.
And they were terrible. They were terrible.
Name sounds familiar though, but.
Oh, they suck. But anyway, I just pulled a memory out from when I was 13 that they had a song, every song they had, right, their Danger Danger, and like their hit song was called Naughty Naughty. Mm. And then every song was like, you know, Bad Bad, or, and so it's like Bite Me Bambi, Bad Boyfriend. I was like, it's, I don't know. There
yeah.
was a.
Yeah, I see the connection. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I realize that's a connection that exists only in my head.
Yeah, as all great connections do, we connect things that other people don't see. That's what makes life so great. But I do think you would like Bite Me Bambi. They're actually from Orange County, and they feature members from the original lineup from Safe Ferris. So,
oh,
yes.
Well, that's a good group.
All right, next up. We have the Write-Ups on January 11th. This Michigan-based ska punk band released their debut self-titled album called The Write-Ups. This album features 9 songs, and the new album from The Write-Ups is streaming everywhere now. Let's take a listen to a clip from their song, Living in the Meantime, We're All Gonna Die.
Doom scroll, my mind completely shuts down. I get up later than I know I should. I smoke up all the healthy film up. Life is fine, we're all gonna die. Life is fine, we're all gonna die. Life is fine, we're all gonna die. Might as well get living in the meantime.
All right, last up on Ska News, we have also from Orange County, California, we have from Half Past Two on January 12th, they released basically 2 songs. They released a cover of Capsule from the Suicide Machines, and they also released a new song called Turn Back the Hands featuring Adam Davis from Omnigon. So let's take a listen to a clip from their original tune called Turn Back the Hands. Past Two, another great band from Orange County, California. So lots of ska out there that you should all check out. And before we jump out of ska news, Matt, I feel like you have something to say.
No, I'm just okay. I'm happy to hear that there's ska bands in Orange County.
Yeah, there's a lot still.
I live in Denver, so.
Yeah, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But also, before we get into our interview with Matt, also want to remind you all that we have a Patreon. Yes, that's right. You can go to patreon.com/ontheupbeatska. Did I say Patreon? Yeah, I did. Patreon.com/ontheupbeatska. Go there. For $4 a month, you get at least 2 bonus episodes a month. We most of the time, we're pretty good at giving you 4 a month, but we under-promise and over-deliver. That's our motto. You get 10% off merch. Who doesn't like discounts on merch? And you also get access to a private Facebook page where I occasionally just post pictures of my dogs. So, or my dog. I only have one dog. Why say dog? I don't know. Where's my brain? But yes, so go to patreon.com/ontheupbeatska. Matt, the Supertones.
You're cracking under the strain of, solo hosting here.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly what happens. Actually, I kind of don't think it's much different. I do, personally, I can tell you, because I'm having to, keep the show going and doing, keeping the tech all online.
Your energy's great. You've been... You're really putting your heart into hosting. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, so Matt, you already proved that you have a clear knowledge of ska music and ska background. But how did you get into ska music? Where did your ska origin story start?
It's a good question. So, I was obsessed with music by age 11, and was a bass player. By age 12, saved up enough to get a bass. And so I would play with various, not very serious bands of my little punk rock friends and stuff at high school. The year was, I want to say, 1990. Sounds right. Freshman year of high school. And a guy I played in a band with, he was into ska. And he was telling me about it. I was 14. And his name is Clay Guccione. Shout out, Clay. He would play me the Specials and Op Ivy. And I loved it. But then I really got into it. I kind of fell in love with it. We went together. His older brother took us to see the Selector on their first reunion tour.
Mm, awesome.
I believe it was up in Redondo Beach. Mm. It was amazing. I had never had so much fun at a concert. I loved everything they were about. I love the Selector to this day. And so once I saw that show, I was like, well, where can I get more? This was before I really knew that there was a Orange County scene, right? You would kind of in high school. This is before the internet, right? The internet. And so you were totally reliant on word of mouth. And so you'd hear some things. Oh, there was a ska show, or I was like, really? There's shows, and of course, the Mighty Mighty Bosstones being that Converse commercial was a seminal moment as well. Just really tried to, I was really into the two-tone stuff mainly, because that's what was available in record stores at that point. And then of course, was the coming of No Doubt.
Right.
When their first record came out, that thing was just everywhere. And, used to go see them and, it got to a point by 1993 where, I don't know, how old are you?
46.
You're 46. So we're, I'm 47. Yeah. You were right. You were there too. In Orange County?
Yes. I wasn't going to scene shows. I got into ska because it got on the radio. I wasn't super connected to a scene, just yet, until basically when ska died, that's when I was connected to a scene. But I definitely know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I wasn't aware that it was like a happening. It was just like, oh, this is great, you know?
Yeah.
And of course it was, I guess there's a little bit of a contrarian in me and a snob. And so to kind of be in on something that other people didn't know about, was part of the appeal as well.
Yeah. So how did they go from, you know, learning about ska, being interested in ska, discovering shows were happening around you, to the start of the Orange County Supertones?
Okay. So, bit of a long story. So it also coincides with when I became a Christian, which was when I was 14 years old, my freshman year of high school. And I was already playing music, and like the one other Christian guy I knew who played guitar, we started a band immediately after I became a Christian. And and we decided we were going to like invent Christian rock, like punk rock. We didn't know that it already existed. But we were like, this is going to be great. And looking back, our music was just an offensively bad. At that point, the drummer for the Supertones, Jason Carson, joined that band. We needed a drummer. This was 1991. I believe. Yes, 1991. He joined the band. And we called our band Saved.
Right on the nose. Just right on that nose.
If there was any question whether or not we were Christians, we wanted to answer that before you ever heard us. And so we kind of we were pretty grab baggy as a band in terms of musical style, just kind of experimenting with things. And so, you know, like little prog punk, a little alternative rock, some ballads in there and some ska songs, all of it terrible. And you know, it was funny because we would play these ska songs and looking back, I mean, calling it ska is, you know,
Generous
labeling of what we were doing. It was our best approximation of ska, I'll put it that way. And often those would get kind of the best audience reaction. And so in 1994, we changed our name to the Supertones and started playing exclusively ska. And that's actually where the writing of our first record started. And so, yeah, we went and recruited horn players. We talked to dorks and nerds who play horns. You know, I mean, I could give you the blow by blow of when people joined or left the band, but that's probably more than you're asking for. And for people who don't know the Supertones, it's not going to be very interesting.
What was it like once you kind of solidified, especially playing ska, and you changed your name to the Supertones? Mm-hmm. What was it like playing in the Orange County, looking back, especially now, what was it like playing, you know, in the Orange County ska scene at that, you know, the mid-90s right there?
Well, I guess we were more immersed in the underground, like, punk, hardcore Christian scene. So if you ever heard of Tooth and Nail Records, the label that we were on, all of the early bands from Tooth and Nail were from Southern California, right. All the hardcore bands, all the alternative bands, notable exceptions as well. But that was really more our world. That's where we knew people. That's where we would get booked. And so we would be the one ska band. 'Cause, you know, it's just, there's a heavier entry barrier with playing ska, because you have to get the horn players, and you know, you can't just play power chord E again and again. You know, like, there's a little more finesse to it. And so, yeah, we were the only band out there, and we would sometimes get booked on to you know, like straight ska shows around Orange County, but not a ton. And we had a habit of our drummer would do a mini sermon every show. And so that would tend to get us uninvited back.
Yeah. So I've heard lots of different stories about the start of the Supertones, and one of them involves the sort of, I feel like it's grown, its myth has grown larger than...
I'll set the record straight. I'm going to shoot you straight. Ask away.
Did Jason really lock the owner of Tooth & Nail Records, like, in a room until he signed you all? Is that, like legitimately, you know, essentially kidnapped an adult? Okay.
So here's what really happened. MXPX was playing their first show in SoCal. I think their first show outside of Washington. Hmm. And so the label had relocated. Tooth & Nail had relocated up there. And MXPX was, you know, Brandon Ebel's baby. Like, he just loved that band.
Right.
Understandable. They're a great band. And so, you know, we were rolling pretty lush back then. So, you know, we would just stay in people's houses or whatever. But that's what MXPX had to do with Brandon. Jason Carson, our drummer, he was promoting shows at our church. He would do a string of shows, very well attended, right? Like, we'd pack out our little church basement with like 800 people, which was, at the time, extraordinarily large, you know. And so, he put up MXPX at his parents' house, along with Brandon. And we had been pestering Brandon to sign us. We had asked him when we were the band Saved, and he gave a hard pass because it was bad. No fault to him. And then, you know, we changed it up and we're like, hey, we're different band, different music, check it out.
Yeah.
And he was still reluctant. And so the morning when they were going to get back on the plane, Jason took the opportunity to pester Brandon in person. And yes, he was in his room. And he would not let Brandon leave. I mean, it wasn't kidnapping. It wasn't detaining someone against their will per se. But he did stand in the doorway and refused to let him out. And I do think that he tried to walk past him. And Jason stopped him. Yes. Okay. No. This sounds like kidnapping, doesn't it?
Just give Jason him a hug. Him.
And he demanded a yes or no answer, and Brandon said no.
Mm. So what was the, how did you eventually get signed to Tooth & Nail? I mean, he, you know, Jason put the hard, you know, hard press on him. He said no, let him get on that plane.
I think it did make him think, though.
Right.
I think it showed him that the Supertones were a group of young men who were prepared to use violence to persuade him. So
for Jesus.
For Jesus. That's right. Yeah, I think it was just, he went back to Seattle, listened back and kind of asked people what they thought, I think is, and then he eventually said yes. It was I think it was like that summer. So this was in spring, I believe, when Jason cornered him. And I might have that timeline a little wonky.
Yeah,
there.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has.
We're going to listen.
Yeah, I think it was a string of shows in spring. He would do, Jason would promote four shows. And just, I'm going to give props again to Jason, because that dude, he's just, still is, but back then as well, was a dynamo. Just promoting shows, doing all kinds of things. Like, he was definitely a major prime mover for the Supertones and for the scene.
Yeah. Sounds awesome. We need those people, whether they're in bands or not. You need those,
absolutely,
people to promote and push, and, you know, whether a particular scene or a particular genre, you need those, because otherwise the needle doesn't move, right?
No, you're right. And right, so my contribution was more on the writing and you know, kind of doing the music, but I think equally important was Jason's just incredible drive to get things done and get management and booking and label and all that stuff. It wouldn't happen without him.
All right. We're going to take a listen to the live version of Resolution off Live Volume 1 from 2002. What can you tell us about this song, both sort of like in Supertones sort of history, but also like what kind of why you picked the live version?
Okay, that's a good question. So I've always liked this song. I think it was one of our better liked songs. I think it charted on the radio, actually.
Hmm.
It was one of our more radio-friendly tunes.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't remember the circumstances under which I wrote it. I think I was 20, about 20 years old. Sounds right. That math adds up, doesn't it?
Sure.
Record came out in 97. We were recording it in winter of 96, 97. Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
20. I was 20.
Math
and
hard.
Huh?
I said math is hard.
Math is super hard. Timelines are very difficult. I don't remember the story behind the song writing it, but I do remember that Tony, our bass player, was really concerned that we would be unable to top our first record. Because, you know, like we thought it was good. And
I was going to say, did he? No, just kidding.
No, I think we knew we could top the recording because we had some budget to work with and a real producer. But I think he was worried writing wise, like how do you come up with better songs than we wrote before? And so, you know, that was I think anyone who has written songs over time, you kind of have songs where you're like, oh, I did something better than I did before. Right. Like I leveled up, you know, in Zelda terms, you know, like I got more powers here. And this is definitely one of those songs. And so I think it also, if I were to play someone just one song of the Supertones, like, hey, what's the Supertones all about? I think that this would be one of the quintessential Supertones songs. And I like the live record better. For a number of reasons. So the Strike Back record, which was our biggest record, I was really unpolished as a singer. And Steve Kravac, who produced that record, we called him Dr. Kravacian. He was of the Fat Mike school of just, you know, very sort of mechanized perfection. Punk rock, you know, like NoFX. And so you did not have vibrato on your voice. And, you know, it was just like that, you know, and MXPX worked with them too. And we love Steve Kravac. He's a very good producer and he is merciless. And so I think that my lack of ability, and this was that we didn't use Pro Tools. This is all the whole record was just, you know, raw tracks. Undoctored. It took me so long to get just in pitch because I was still learning how to sing really. That I think that the album version doesn't have as much character and feeling. You know, because just trying to make it sound halfway decent pitch wise up to Steve Kravac standards does tend to rob it of some vibe.
Yeah.
And so the live version, obviously, you know, we weren't doing multiple takes. It was smoking live. And also, I think, you know, our calling card was not our records so much as our live show, right? Like for many ska bands, you know, like that's the true test of a ska band is how you are live.
Yeah.
And so, I love our live record. One of my heroes was the producer on it, Bill Stevenson, the drummer for the Descendants.
Right.
He came out on the road with us for a few days with his whole live rig set up. So fantastic to like I was fanboying pretty hard on him because that's like one of my favorite bands ever.
I forgot that. I completely, wow. That's.
And so when Bill Stevenson said, man, I like your band, I nearly just melted right then. And he's, oh, you're a good singer, man. It's like, Bill That's it. I can sing. And so, yeah, that's I think it's my favorite record too. You can hear just like we really had a lot of fun on stage.
Yeah.
And you hear that on the record. So that's it.
For listeners, live records can be hit or miss, but this is definitely one of my favorite live records of all time. Sometimes I'm like, hey, you want to turn that audience down? Like, I don't need to hear the audience so much, but, this live record is great. So yes, we're going to check out, live version of Resolution off the 2002, live record, Live Volume 1. Let's check it out. We'll come back and chat some more.
Without any more jibber jabber on my part, we're going to play another song.
Make my resolution.
Supertones Strike Back, you know, like you said earlier, is your biggest record.
Yep.
As it grew in popularity, you all kind of started playing, you know, I think you guys played on an MTV show and your video was played on MTV. What was that time like as it started to get sort of outside of your immediate scene? You were getting attention. What was that time like?
Okay. So let's not blow things out of proportion. So for our younger listeners, there was a time when MTV played videos, music videos, and that's how you saw videos.
Yeah. No YouTube, kids. No YouTube.
And so, you know, I used to love just watching, like 120 minutes. What was his name? Matt Pinfield.
Pinfield. Yep.
It was like, you know, this amazing encyclopedia of records, the guy knew everything. And so, you know, when our video was going to be on 120 minutes, and, you know, like we stayed up super late. I remember I was at my girlfriend's house in Ohio and stayed up to watch it. And like, you know, Matt Pinfield said our name.
Yeah.
And he said, "You may not realize it, but that was a ska version of Creeping Death by Metallica at the beginning." Is that a good Matt Pinfield impression?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
His voice almost really was like going to give out. This is more on the beam, isn't it? It's like Joe from The Insiders or Dickie from The Boston's. Just very strained. Sounds like he's being punched.
That was a great moment for me. We never got in real rotation on MTV. Mm. So I think we made 120 minutes a couple times, which was a late night underground alternative show.
True.
And then, yeah, we played in studio at the MTV studios in New York City. I remember flying in early that morning and being in cabs. And I was like, what is going on? I was like 21 years old, you know? And we played on a show called Oddville.
Yeah, and that was the name of it. Yeah, I couldn't think of
Oddville. It was weird. It was just, I forget
it was like a talk show, but the guy was very...
He was a funny guy.
Yes.
The guy who hosted it was really funny.
I'm not even sure. I kind of feel like it was a character, not who the person was.
No. Absolutely, he was... But I mean, he was making good TV, but...
Yeah.
It was like... you know, they had like a vampire on, a guy who was like, said he was a vampire.
Yes. It was like an alternative talk show.
It was like an alternative talk show, Oddville, but it was like you brought out people who would be in maybe a circus freak show, that sort of thing. And I'm not sure if we can say freak show these days. So I'm a little
concerned
about the reception of it. But that's we played it. We played to a wall. There was no one.
There was no audience.
And I was so nervous doing the song Supertones Strike Back. I just, you know, we wanted to give it everything we had, and I didn't steward my breath well. And so when your adrenaline is way jacked, you can actually run out of breath a lot easier. I think famously, Axl Rose, on the Grammys or MTV Music Awards, when Guns N' Roses came back, remember that?
Yeah.
In like 2002, he was out of breath. And everybody had a lot of funny things to say about it. Yeah. But I was like, I know, Axel. I know how that feels to run out of breath singing on TV. your adrenaline is going. And but that was the extent of our performances on MTV.
But I imagine it was like very surreal in some sense, because you're like, now I'm on the types of things that I used to watch, right? Like,
and was still watching.
Yeah.
I was only 21. absolutely. It was definitely very strange. It was fun. I think that anyone who's ever been married can describe the feeling of your wedding day as going like you remember it, but it goes by in sort of like a blur.
Right.
And things are just happening before you even totally get the total import of it.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think that period for us was very much like that.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's a perfect example of that. 'Cause that is exactly what my wedding day was. I remember snapshots. I mostly remember the pictures that came from it, but that's kind of all that's kind of there.
So, right. Yeah. And even how you were responding, you're like, I could have done better.
Right. I could have smiled more. I could have done
a little more relaxed, but you're not relaxed. You're like, what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. What's my line again? Oh, I do. Got it. Yeah. All right. So hip hop was a big influence on the sound of the Supertones.
Very much so.
What are some of your favorite hip hop artists?
That's a good question, man. I really love the golden era stuff. The stuff that I was listening to when I was writing the Supertones stuff, my number one favorite of all time is Public Enemy.
Yeah.
And so you could hear a lot of that. I was blatantly biting Chuck D to the best of my ability. Eric B and Rakim. That was a big one too. Run DMC, of course. And I think, you know, oddly, one of the biggest influences on the Supertones was the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, I could hear that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like I said before, we played all sorts of musical styles. But if you listen to the Supertones, really, there's all of that stuff just in one song.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, very, very much so. The Wu-Tang Clan was huge for me at that time. I still love them. But that was very influential as well. Let's see, what else? Tribe Called Quest. That was big. The Roots. Mainly all that golden age old school stuff.
Yeah. I think that is one of the things that set the Supertones apart.
Yes.
In ska in general, is to how heavily hip hop was influenced. Not only in sort of like you essentially rapping over a ska beat, but also, you know, Chase the Sun is kind of a hip hop song for the most part. You know?
There's a drum machine on it. And also on the song Unite, right? Like there's an 808 under there.
Oh, yeah.
And a record scratch that we actually pulled from a Public Enemy record instead of hiring a DJ.
All right. You mentioned that, you know, during when you were doing your Matt Pinfield impression, you mentioned how the Supertones, at least in a couple songs, kind of pulled from Metallica. I'm wondering, did you ever get any backlash or sort of like wagging of the finger about using a Metallica, that evil satanic band?
No, not at all.
Really?
Or did
did people just not know?
I don't know, but we never heard. No one said boo. Actually, if you listen, our very first record starts off with the intro to Am I Evil? And then our second record starts off with Creeping Death. And then for our third record, we didn't start the record this way, but we did Damage Incorporated before one song. The riff to Damage Incorporated anyway. And then on Metallica was getting very Sue happy. And so for our fourth record, we just did a tribute without doing an actual Metallica song, the way the record started. It was kind of like... And then, we didn't, on the fifth record, we didn't do anything because it wouldn't have fit. And then on our sixth record, we did, I don't think it's a Metallica song. Again, we were afraid of being sued by Metallica. And so we just did another thing that sounded like Metallica the beginning of that record.
Yeah. Especially the early 2000s, Lars was suing everyone who like, but you weren't giving, I guess technically you were giving away their music. So you were, I guess.
We were profiting off of it actually.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I guess. Yeah.
We were selling it.
All right. So for our listeners, it's probably a great deal of our listeners, maybe who didn't experience or wasn't a part of the Christian music alternative scene. What was that like for you? Did it seem, I don't know, did it ever feel, because that was always my worry especially when it comes to Christian music. Was there ever a moment you all felt like a novelty to the Christian scene? Did that ever?
No, because we were, at our peak, we were one of the three biggest bands of the whole scene. So we were, we were a main stage act. We weren't like a sideshow. And so, no, I think that it was definitely different, right?
Yeah.
Like, we weren't Southern, which is the vast majority. Is pretty Southern and Midwestern. Yeah. So we were California guys. We did not know there was a Nashville. We did not know there was a Christian music industry. We were, grew up in the Southern California thing.
Right.
And so we were always a little different, but it was never any problem, never any static with it.
Yeah. Were there ever,
of the Southern accents though, I'll tell you that.
you guys spent pretty much from, I guess from the first time, your Adventures of Supertones came out, mm-hmm. pretty much all the way to 2005, touring very regularly, pretty yearly, I would assume, in about 10-year span. Is there
150 to 200 shows a year?
Wow, that's a lot.
We had to eat.
Yeah. Is there a story from the road that really stands out to you as like, man, that's the story that comes to mind when you think about touring with the Supertones?
Like something that would be a typical?
Typical, but also very memorable.
Here's the thing. The experience of touring is characterized mainly by monotony.
Yeah.
And we called it Groundhog's Day because, it was an incredibly boring, monotonous life. and this was before you had internet and Uber and all this stuff. So you were really stuck wherever you were.
Yeah.
You just wait around until there's something to do, and then you hurry up and go do it, and then you're waiting around and driving and showering, and and it's just the thing that you remember, and I think every touring band who's more like mid-level could attest to this, is it is just to keep yourself from like getting depressed is doing pretty good. And so memorable stories would be the exception to the rule.
Right.
When something really memorable and fun happens, and sometimes you manufacture that.
Sure, sure.
Yes, there were many of those moments. Things do happen on the road, but none of the memorable things would really be characteristic of what most of life on the road is like.
So what was your favorite memory of something you did to stave off that boredom?
Oh gosh. Well, I kind of had my own routine, right? I was always a reader. Hmm. And so I would typically get a gopher or a runner to take me someplace where I could just drink coffee and read. And that was my day. I got through stacks. I would just hit used bookstores on the road and just stock up, and then I would read them. And I realized that that's real boring. that's how I staved off boredom. The other guys would get into things like building model rockets, like painstaking work on model rockets that actually launch. We'd have a launch day. They got the guys all went and bought little scooters, gas powered. Terrible idea on the bus. I mean, just asking to die. And they would ride around on those things. The Newsboys, of course, which is a Christian band, they famously would bring out all of their dirt bikes on the road, and they would go dirt bike riding, not BMX, like motorcycle dirt bikes.
Right.
That was fun. We did that.
Yeah.
One time we got to go to a shooting range. That was cool.
I bet that. Yeah, that's definitely breaking that monotony for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. No, there's a lot of stuff like that over the years, but let's see. Oh, there was the time where our trombone player jumped off a bridge in Chicago into the Chicago River.
Oh, how'd that go? How'd that end up, though?
He was fine. He was fine. It was around 2 a.m. We had been out on a day off in Chicago, which is a great town. Greek town, I believe, is where we were. And we were walking back to the hotel. And as we were walking across a bridge, our guitar player at the time said, "Hey, how much would you guys pay me to jump off this bridge into the river?" Right? 2 a.m. things seem reasonable.
Sure.
And so we were like, "Oh, you really going to do it?" He's like, yeah, how much?" And so we kind of figured out what we had cash wise. And we were like, $112. And he's like, "Are you really going to do it?" He's like, "No." And then Dan, our trombone player, just goes, $112, huh? Right? We're like, yeah. And Dan is for real. He's a wild man. And so right there, he just got up, climbed to the other side of the bridge, you know, kind of hanging on. Don't do this at home, kids, by the way.
Right.
Don't ever do this. And he'd.
This was performed by a professional Scott.
By a professional trombone player. So he was qualified. And yeah. He breathed hard for a couple seconds, psyched himself up, and he went for it. And popped right back up, swam to the shore. I mean, all kinds of things could have gone poorly with that, but he came out unscathed and $112 richer, I might add.
Yeah, yeah.
And with a pretty good story.
Yeah, that's pretty. Now, are you going to tell me the bridge was like, you know, like one story? You know,
I don't know exactly. I'm sure that some of your listeners who might live in Chicago or have lived in Chicago could tell you a more accurate. To me, it looked quite high.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It looked 2 stories at least, 3 stories maybe. But no, because like boats have to fit under there, so yeah. there needs to be some decent clearance.
Yeah.
I don't remember the levels of the river.
I'm sure you were like, "Hold on, guys, let's check this out."
It was summertime, though. I will tell you that.
Okay,
so the weather was nice.
Summertime in Chicago probably wasn't well. It was 2 a.m, so it was probably pretty cold afterwards. But yeah,
I don't imagine it was bathwater-ish or anything like that.
That's awesome. So, you know, and over the time we've been doing this podcast, we have talked to a lot of different bands, and one of the periods of time that I find most interesting, especially with bands that sort of like came up in the 90s and then moved through the early 2000s, and since pop culture very much functioned very differently at that time, was there a time for the Supertones where maybe that discussion of like, maybe we do less ska, you know, and put that out? Was that ever, did that specifically happen? Ever, or was it whatever, anytime there was maybe less ska on a record, was that just sort of a natural occurrence?
No, it was definitely intentional. So I think you can hear on our third record, we were trying to introduce some new things. And then by our fourth record, you know, when ska was declining in popularity, we definitely started to move away from ska without trying to, we're trying to stretch without snap, right? Without snapping. And then by record number 5, it's not ska at all. If you listen to that record.
Yeah.
And then we said, yeah, we didn't love that. There's some good tunes on it, but it's not really us. And so our sixth record or fifth, sixth record. Yeah. Six record, Revenge of the Supertones was definitely back. Like, hey, we're a ska band, it's definitely difficult. I think it's to people from the outside, it's like, well, why don't you just do what you're good at, right? Like, I like it because you're a ska band, right? And from the inside, you know, you have the pressure of making back your budget because, sure, you know, every record is a big investment by the label. And, you know, like, this is how you pay your bills, and you don't want your band to decline in popularity. So as the thing with which you're tied to is sinking, you're trying to not sink.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely hard, but I do want to say, I actually loved Hi-Fi Revival.
Thank you.
Yes, I was listening to it the other day and I was like, this is such a really good record. Yes. There's like arguably no ska on it at all, but it is such a happy record sounding. It's very bright. It's got a lot of energy to it. And it just makes me happy every time I put it on. And
it's a little too polished, I think, in my opinion. I would have liked a little more stank on it, little more natural sound to it, but it does sound good. I'm really, really critical of our work. You know, like, I feel like every record has like two songs I still like in their entirety, but that's me.
Yeah. I think a lot of artists feel that way a lot of the times too. Cause like you said, like, you can fall in love with maybe the overall writing and the sound of the song, but maybe there's something about the production that just didn't, in the end, doesn't click for you.
Yeah, production or lyrics, that's a big one for me. I will regularly, this is funny, I'll be like doing the dishes or something like that, and a lyric I wrote will pop in my head from a random song I hadn't thought about in 10 years. And I'll just go, oh, that's bad. Oh, gosh, I wish I had that one back. You know?
Let's just hope no one listens to it. Or they don't catch it, right? Because you're doing it
right. No, I don't think it's going to bother other people the same way it bothers me.
Yeah.
But it bothers me.
All right. Well, Matt, thank you for hanging out tonight and doing this episode with me.
Pleasure.
Before we wrap up this episode, of course, we're going to do Ska Picks of the Week. Matt, why don't you tell us about your ska pick?
Well, I'm going to go back to my ska roots. The first ska show I ever saw, The Selector, on my radio. I bought my baby a red radio. He played it all day. I go go, I go go. He liked to dance to it down in the streets. He said he loved me, but he loved the beat. But when I switch on, I rotate the dial. I can see it ain't driving him so wild. I bought my baby a red radio. He said he loved me, but he had to go. It's just the same old show.
That is, Selector is definitely one of the bands from the two-tone era that I have gravitated towards, like, pretty heavily. I actually do like their sound a lot. So my ska pick of the week is from a band called Divide by Zero. They are based out in New York. They have a new song called Sure as Hell, and I think it's pretty good. Let's check it out.
Voices calling me. These 80 surroundings are just lies we're blind, we'll never see.
sometimes without judgment. Somebody tell me this is the best way for me to live my life. But I said, hey, hey, have you ever even tried to empathize? This little world of mine gets better every day because I try. But I won't listen, it's sure as hell not your decision.
All right, Matt, thank you so much for hanging out this week. I appreciate it. Listeners, if you want to hear more from Matt from the Orange County Supertones, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/ontheupbeatska, where Matt is going to stick around for a little bit of a bonus chat. And you can check that out and sign up, and you get a bunch of other, like, I think we're up to like 70 or 75 bonus episodes. So there's a lot for you all to check out. All right. All right.
Farewell, plebeians. I'll see the paying people. Patreon.
Thank you, listeners, for listening and supporting this podcast any way that you do. Thank you for listening. And until next time, keep listening to ska. You've been listening to On the Upbeat. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so you get all the new episodes as soon as they're available. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at On the Upbeat Ska. Follow our Spotify playlist, Ska Favorites. It features all the songs heard on the show. Please consider joining our Patreon. Visit patreon.com/ontheupbeatska to sign up today. And thank you for supporting On the Upbeat.
Where are you from? Orange County. Orange County, huh?